Brilliant. All right, thank you. I just want to say thank you for coming, undergraduate students. Really glad to see you here and looking forward to hearing what you have to say in class. In the spirit of this conference, which is to move beyond false senses of closure, I hope to try and ask questions rather than pretending to answer them. I want to express my deep gratitude to the organizers and to everybody whose labor is making this conference possible. I am especially grateful for the manifesto. You voiced thoughts that so many of us have had over the past few years, and it's an amazing contribution. So today I'm going to talk about what I call over-narrativization, presenting some histories, some alternatives, some warnings. Over-narrativization doesn't necessarily mean against story or beyond story, but it certainly means too much story. Our former Librarian of Congress, James Billington, liked to say and said over and over again, stories unite people, theories divide them. Stories unite people, theories divide them. It's funny, I always wanted it to be the other way around. Almost everyone in the media and the history and the museum businesses, and I use that word intentionally, obsessively, emphasizes the word story and repeats how basic story is to our humanity. Where does all that anxiety come from? Story's in control, it's hegemonic, but if it was as deeply ingrained in our consciousnesses as the storytellers claim it is, we wouldn't have to pledge allegiance to it so often. But while many of us are here to critique story, we might also remember that what we generally call storytelling has progressive, even radical origins. In the 1930s, a revival of folk culture and a workerist left helped build awareness of by and about rural and working class people. WPA workers were paid to collect the narratives of former slaves. Storytelling's interpretive capabilities posed a radical alternative to mass culture. And many cultural workers in the 1970s appropriated this and other practices from the 30s, hoping to fit radical narrativity into the toolbox of revolutionary cultural practices. This plus a growing understanding that the personal was political also made storytelling a key feminist practice. In the 1970s, we know that independent documentary acquired a certain cachet and developed into a small but significant business. We see independent docs on public TV. And then in the 1980s, cable and home video begin to commission original programming from independent and even radical documentary makers. I'm getting over a cold, so forgive the static. New distribution systems require cheap programming. Over time, they tend to look for cheap airtime in similar places, archives for one, independently produced media for another. And then, as nonfiction became a business, it began to converge with its fictional other. This has been well described. This is a still from an industrial film about Geiger counters for the family. Before I soured on the supposed universality of narrative, I was a bit of an angry archivist or a disappointed one. Images from my archives propagated widely in the media, but rarely had a chance to ride solo. They were clipped short, shown with overbearing narration or emotionally invasive music. They were deployed not for the evidence they contained or their formative ambiguity, but to serve as narrative glue, continuity fixes, B-roll. The idea that archival clips might prompt audiences to learn to watch and listen more deeply, to view themselves as historical beings, this was suppressed. Bits and pieces from our collections were being woven into works that weakened and sometimes trivialized their components. I hoped, and I still hope, that archives could speak for themselves, or if not completely for themselves, without a lot of filters. I made Laserdisc and CD-ROM anthologies of entire films with contextual materials and a little 3-inch Rick telling you kind of what to think. I worked with Internet Archive to build an online digital collection, and I made screenings. In 1991, I was invited to Britton, South Dakota, a town of about 1,400 people, to show some home movies from 1938-39 in a local theater. To keep a very long story short, the town was still there, the theater was still there, and many people in the films were still alive. So was Ivan Bessie, who shot them. Until that day, I had never seen European Americans talk back to the screen. In 2006, excuse me, I began making urban history documentary events. There are now about 25 of them, which have been presented about 105 times to maybe 45,000 people, don't really know. These barely plotted events, sometimes called lost landscapes, leverage public assembly and mass dialogic presence as a means of creating multiple co-equal consensuses around historical evidence that can be read in multiple ways and try to mobilize audiences to produce their own narrative of the moment on the fly. To speak plainly, I show intricately assembled and lightly edited footage, especially home movies, to audiences who talk to one another in the dark. Is there a story? Sort of. This is New York City around June 16, 1945. It's a background process plate made for rear projection, saved by accident. Turns out to be an incredible record. We're going south on 8th Avenue from about 48th Street. Actually, I think we're a little further down. Is it a story? Sort of. There are arrangements, sometimes topographic, sometimes topical. There's a measure of causality, and some segments are nested inside others. But in general, the audience, excuse me, who is often familiar with the places in the film, makes their own narrative. There's the old Penn Station on the left, and you notice the lack of traffic control. Thank you. Oh, that's great. Unlike almost all films, this is the 1939 World's Fair. These are made for noisy audiences. They are dialogical encounters where I work with audiences, that's you, to set the terms for discussion. And unlike most interactive or participatory documentaries, they're realized through public assembly rather than algorithm. They don't use browsers, apps, or social media platforms to connect viewers. They just use the human voice. Live MCs, encouraging audiences to raise their voice in real time. This kind of behavior has been policed out of movie theaters, but it's actually an echo of traditional practices, the presence of the benshi, the live narrator, in Japanese silent cinema, the performative spectatorship occurring in pre-multiplex urban cinemas where the rule of science, the rule of silence never strictly applied, the Elizabethan theater, whose pits were often said to be populated by the rowdy groundlings who commented loudly on plays and performers. That's a highly engaged form of audience interactivity. Later, the theatrical space functioned as a vertical, as a virtual stage onto which racially integrated audiences performed social relations. In Elizabeth Maddock Dillon's great book, New World Drama, she talks about how the deterritorialized common lands were remapped into the space of the theater, that 18th and early 19th century audience members didn't just go to the theater to see a play, they went to represent themselves, to make common space and often common cause. In 1804, a Boston writer complained that the theater didn't have bright enough lighting during the show, because people weren't there just to see it. And when Richard III was performed at the Bowery Theater in New York in 1832, over 300 audience members swarmed the stage to assist in slaying the tyrannical king. I need to be, LA Union Station just opened up. I need to be clear that this project wasn't premeditated. It's been finding its own way for 13 years. And while I used to see it as radical, I now think of it as radically traditionalist. All of these are excerpts from Lost Landscapes events. This is close to the beginning of Los Angeles, and here is a wedding, a community wedding in 1947 or thereabouts at the Old Mission Church downtown. Not much of the bride, unfortunately. In the 1920s, this is a family in San Francisco in the early 50s. I've been trying to find them because I'd like to repatriate this film. It's a beautiful film that makes people think a little bit differently about the history of San Francisco, especially Catholic San Francisco, which is usually described as an Irish and Italian city. In the 1920s, Bertolt Brecht spoke of the sports audience, particularly those assembled to watch a boxing match, as an ideal audience for his epic theater. Such audiences are highly knowledgeable and aware, uninhibited, vocal, opinionated, keen observers, keeping their eyes on the course rather than simply eyes on the finish. I love this idea of the sports audience. In some ways, it's the audience I'd like to have. They deserve their movie back. This is The Drug War in 1914, but this time directed against the Chinese community in San Francisco. SF police and treasury agents burning opium outside San Francisco City Hall. Part of this was, it was no secret that they were very interested in, they were disappointed that Chinese people had reclaimed Chinatown after the earthquake, but the pressure was still on. In my shows, I urge people to focus on the future rather than the past, but the conflict between those who look back and those who look forward doesn't always result in discussion. The results depend on the state of the city, the composition of the audience, their mood, but they point the way to a low-tech way of re-enlisting viewers in making their own film. One film isn't the same to all audience members. This is Earl Caldwell. He was a reporter for the New York Times, embedded in 1970 with the Black Panther Party, with the occupiers of Alcatraz Island, covered the Angela Davis trial. This is being filmed by Oswald Sykes, who came to San Francisco to the National Rehabilitation Association to offer an alternative to the racist leadership of that group. He loved San Francisco and shot images of his friends and sort of local activity. When I do my Detroit film, I found that black and white Detroiters often see very different films, and there's a vexing contradiction. I love granular evidence, but the filter of local history tends to throw up granular detail as a defense against tough questions, irreconcilable questions. This is the bathtub, a charter taking Native activists to Alcatraz, where it's just currently under occupation. We've connected with the son of the skipper. The original skipper is no longer with us, and we're trying to identify the activists here who are on their way to the island in 1970. I see San Francisco, Detroit, Oakland, LA, and others as cities of extreme contestation, cities in which battles were fought to maintain racialized power and control, cities filled with zones where your bodily safety was contingent and still is on race, class, gender, age. Not everyone who comes to my films wants to recall how African American people have been priced out and redeveloped out of San Francisco, especially since World War II, or how Asian families were prohibited from living on the west side of the city for many years, or in Detroit, how realtors targeted their advertising at different groups as a way of blockbusting the city for profit. I hypothesize that when people focus on this granular detail, when did this movie theater move from this neighborhood to this neighborhood, it screens out uncomfortable issues, deals with people's worry, perhaps, about evoking anger, triggering conflict. And I've actually stopped working in Detroit because although I work with Detroiters, there are too many settlers, and I'm just not comfortable being one. Needs to become a community-owned project. Needs to be repatriated. Everybody wants to show the films, but it's not about the film. This is not about the film. It's about the process. If we think of screenings, and this is a message in a way or a question, not as ends but as means, screenings as community projects where work happened at the neighborhood level and perhaps coalesced into some kind of a film, to shift the emphasis from putting on events to enabling a process of local connection and discovery. This relocates historical agency from one filmmaker to many, and maybe trains people in media. And my positionality is also a very real issue. This is the Jones family in Long Beach, California, in 53, I believe, or 54. Who am I to speak about these cities? to interpolate oneself as a teller or reteller of histories is to construct one's own pedestal. These aren't my own stories to tell. In general, I think of these events as inputs to a process that I only assist as a scout or as a presenter, rather than an interpreter or authority. I tell people that the future of the city is theirs to decide, theirs to struggle for, and these images are to support their discussions. And then, of course, the materials online so that they can use it themselves. I love that. This is his story. One might ask, is this filmmaking? We're filmmakers. Most of us in this room are filmmakers, and we live to make films, but perhaps making films is the problem. Could we expand our understanding of cinema to encompass works made primarily for participatory public assemblies? And could we think about interactive and participatory documentary without assuming that interactivity and participation have to be enabled through technological means? And could we imagine that it might not only be possible but formative to resist interactive forms that are primarily realized algorithmically or through digital platforms? The model is spreading. You know, I don't think I'm going to really be able to show this all to you, but in March, I convened a workshop of makers in Pamplona, Spain, who took footage supplied by local archives and YouTube, and they made a local history film. They made a local history film in 4 days. Here are some clips. Many of them are Basque nationalists, so the film expressed a strong sense of political commitment. It just showed a few hours ago, a second screening in San Sebastian, Donostia, and I think there's going to be more of this in Spain. It ends, and I unfortunately can't scrub here, but it ends with this Up With People style singing, which had to be explained to me. The film ends with music from the youth wing of Opus Dei, the ultra-conservative institution within the Catholic Church that controls many of the institutions around Pamplona, including the university. It's wonderful, but let's go on. Some things I'm learning. Narrative, at worst, is packaging. And many films are already fairly arbitrary assemblies of emotional triggers presented as attractive packages. A good yarn weaves its own scarf. It needs no excessive trim. And documentation is itself compelling. It can be its own narrative. I think we're going to hear something about this, although Penny Lane on Facebook seems to disagree. As we walk through a cemetery, the stones suggest stories, and we're often drawn to think of the communities in which deceased people lived. Names and social groups might suggest narratives. The enigmas we see in the unendowed sections are especially telling. There are so many ways people have constructed narratives without reverting to storytelling. Here's the list of prisoners who sought medical attention at the tombs in August 1944. Look at the claims of police violence transcribed with skepticism by the doctor on duty, George R. Stewart, and a beautiful passage describes a transcontinental journey in terms of the forestation of the country that we pass over. Marge Piercy, and we should read this, I'll let it sit, frames the city through different personal geographies. This paragraph is itself a film treatment. Or an alt future shown through the Soviet military map of the San Francisco Bay Area, or quilts. This is a quilt with family history from a Quaker community in 1843, or reef photography. I couldn't find a good reef photography picture, so this is my front window, the projector there, and then it's gone. You know, it's kind of like having a giant tooth in front of a dentist, you know. Reef photography proves that the minimum you need to build a narrative is two frames. home movies kind of brilliantly address the over-narrativization problem, because every home movie is, at minimum, a capsule narrative. It's the articulation of a relationship between the shooter and who or what is being shot. And many home movies are even more complex. Home movies tempt audiences to identify their intimacy and historical material counterweight one another, and they have immense evidentiary value. This is New Year's at a bar on Bunker Hill in Los Angeles. The change of scale when a movie made to be shown on a small screen hits the big screen, the audience changes role. They get new modes of agency. They turn into ethnographers, noticing and remarking on every visible detail of kinship, word, gesture, exchange. They respond as cultural geographers. If you could capture the voices, and you can't record 100 people at once, the recording might be an urban research project distributed through a crowd of investigators. Except when I first showed Landscapes of New York, where this comes from, in a hipster bar in Brooklyn in kind of an underground premiere, this shot comes up from 1937, and somebody says, "Awesome font." I don't propose these arrangements as models, but as provocations. We cannot deny stories history, but we can stop short of eternalizing it. We can insist on its cultural and historical specificity and resist trying to force the non-human into human frames and let go the idea that most human narratives are containable within the kind of media we collectively make. Not all stories are filmable. Not all can be contained within the glowing rectangle. Some should remain embedded in individual and collective memory, body, landscape, fauna, earth, and some belong to other temporalities. So much is happening now outside the world of documentary. In the archives world, people are starting to speak of archives as speculative places, places where we might rehearse new arrangements, not only of history, but of society, as Bethany Novisky puts it, counterinsurgencies to inevitability, many challenges to temporality, especially dominant white settler sense of temporality. So I don't seek to bury the algorithm, but I question any retreat from public assembly, especially if it's kind of happening under the rubric of engagement, as so much interactive cinema asserts. Public assembly substitutes affective power based on presence and unpredictability for the simulative power of algorithmic medium. We're not always going to be able to rely on programmers, sysadmins, code, and connectivity to enable community in virtual spaces. And I would also argue that restoring big screen experience coupled with direct participation is a route towards staging the meeting of difference without its dilution, a means to an end rather than an end in itself. And finally, you know, public assembly begs the question, what ends could it serve? The confluence of shared interests that lead people to gather in a room for a film signifies the commencement of a process that most films don't try to take further. What more could we do with an assembly gathered in a room than simply screen a movie? Could we stimulate audiences to take on greater agency and new responsibilities? Could a screening be a model for deeper participation, for collective efforts to remediate conditions that resist individualized activity? Could we try to make theater in a round, in a rectangular box? Could we model a new commons? At this, I'm aware that perhaps we need to rethink the idea of the commons and understand how, at least in North America, it rests upon foundational violence and dispossession, to quote Gomez Barris, but I still want to propose public assembly and the raising of voices as a counterforce to media that insists on being consumed in silence and hires private guards to police its theaters. So, what next? There's a compulsion to reconstruct the enclosures of the past, even while building futures. Expanding possibilities bring out ambivalence. What's exciting in Amsterdam and Sheffield is scary in Burbank. The suits are scared at the new kinds of media making. Will the future of media making progress past old stories? Not necessarily. It's a bad sign when we see a lot of capital funding new platforms. As scholars and non-traditional makers, we support and often honor experiments in narrative. But those who occupy the lower tier of a two-tier system policed by gatekeepers and distributors, where participation is contingent on so many rules. Our agency is limited, but we could always aspire to make dialogical, liberating work. We could ask more of ourselves and of our viewers. As water finds new ways to flow through a plane, we could help etch new cognitive paths in people's minds. In my opinion, one of Google's innovations, and I hate to credit them with anything, but one of their innovations was to take the structure out of the data and put it into the query. It's my understanding that the data in their vast web cache is fairly unstructured, and that when we send Google a query, they contextualize it with their vast knowledge of us, our habits and desires, and they whittle down vast possibilities into the subset they think we might want to see. What does this tell us as makers and critics? It might tell us that structure is not inevitably a necessary part of the story, that how the audience approaches the work is much more significant, that we might locate narrative intelligence in the audience rather than in the work itself. To use a cybernetic analogy, and a poor one, I think, put the data in the movie, but rely on viewers to execute the code to interpret it. As online news pioneer Bill Dunn put it a long time ago in words that we should never forget, the metadata exceeds the importance of the data it describes. Might it be that our job is to offer viewers strategies for sentience and rewards for decoding, to treat them at least part of the time like gamers with lives to gain? Might our works resemble the internet as it was originally designed to be, smart at the periphery, dumb at the center? And finally, just because the tools to create mass media are easy to access than ever before, does this mean we should actually aspire to make mass media just because we can? Or should we work within familiar communities, hang near home, stay off of airplanes? If we're going to trim the weeds of narrative, we might begin in our own gardens. Thank you so much.